This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. It's a slow sports week, so let's do some digging here into the sports bin, see what turns up. Get the balsa glider competition out in Walla Walla. The Winter Horseshoes World Cup. It's in Burwash Landing. I think that's in the Yukon. And we got the Cuernavaca Dart Sectionals. Finally, oh, this looks interesting. Super Bowl XLI in Miami. I wonder if that's Florida or Ohio. I'll bet Paul Attner, who's in Miami, will know the answer to that one. Hello, Paul.
Well, Bill, there's salsa dancing. Does that make it Miami?
Who knew?
Super Bowl week. I showed up in Miami, and they were, doing a lot of dancing, and it was a lot of Latin music. And I said, I bet this is the right place.
And you were right. And 2 weeks of relentless hype have yielded stories of two black head coaches, a player accused of a serious crime on at least two or three different occasions who nevertheless has special dispensation to play in the Super Bowl, speculation over whether this will be Peyton Manning's year or whether Rex Grossman will set a Super Bowl record with 43 interceptions. Has any of this intrigued you?
I think the fact that there are two black coaches, I think that's a legitimate story. I think it's a legitimate sign of long-needed progress, not only in the NFL, but in professional sports itself. I think the NFL has been playing catch-up in a lot of areas, and I think the fact that we knew long ago it obviously didn't matter the color of anyone's skin whether they could coach or not, but it seemed like it took the NFL a long time to recognize that. And Lovie Smith and Tony Dungy are two just really nice men, and they've done it without screaming, without yelling, without belittling their players, all types of things that I really admire in coaches, period. And so they've done it in the right way, and they're here, and I just feel a little bit better about the Super Bowl because of that. The rest of it, Bill, is the Super Bowl. it's today's story, and it's just really goes from year to year, is just kind of filling different characters, and it's almost the same storylines.
Does the fact that we've got two black coaches in the Super Bowl have an impact down the line on the NFL, and not just head coaches, mm-hmm. assistant coaches, administrators, general managers, et cetera?
Well, the part of me that is idealistic like to say yes. You need to hire the best people and not going further than that. So you would think that, if anything, it would reinforce that notion. How it turns, into reality, we'll see. But what I just said means you've got to have legitimate people who can do the job. And that's the thing here. You've got to, if you interview, a black head coach who's got the ability, hire him. But if he doesn't have the ability, you shouldn't hire him, just like you shouldn't hire a white coach. So he's still going to be good enough to do the job, but I hopefully at least maybe open the door up for more interviews of qualified candidates, and hopefully the best guys do get hired.
Paul, back in the fall of 2005, I was in Chicago, and I went to a Bears game and talked to a bunch of fans there, and they all, of course, said, boy, I hope the Bears get back to the Super Bowl soon. But who could have predicted over a year ago the Bears would be vying for Vince's gilded pigskin as soon as 2007?
Especially with Rex Grossman as their quarterback. That's even more.
Who was surprising. In junior high 2 years ago,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and he still looks like it, too, by the way. But one of the intriguing things to me is that the Bears are here in this game with an inferior quarterback, which makes what you're saying even more surprising, because they didn't really improve themselves at the most vital position of any on a team. What's nice about this team is they're kind of doing it like you'd like the Bears to do it. They're doing it on defense, running the ball. They're tough. They talk tough. The Bears kind of monsters of Midway's image, and so that's good. I'd rather, they came down here as a finesse team, kind of like the Colts. You say, oh, boy, that doesn't fit good at all. But they're a good fit. Now, it doesn't mean they're good enough to win, but at least they're a good fit.
Of course, Indy fans have known this day would come for the Colts. It's just that they've known it for 5 years in a row, right?
Bill, that sounds a little cynical to me. they it's long overdue. They've been the best team in football, I'd say, probably for the last 3 years, except they've had a little problem in the playoffs. They couldn't win the right games. And, I think it is Peyton Manning's time, and I think it is the Colts' time. And, again, it's nice to see them here because they have worked so hard to get to this level. They've kind of blown it before, and this year they took advantage of their opportunities, and they've shown up in this game.
The last four Super Bowls have been played in Detroit, Jacksonville, Houston, and Bear Gut Bayou, Mississippi, I think it was. Did the NFL feel the need to get the big game back into a more familiar and lucrative locale?
Yeah, well, I think this certainly is one of their anchor positions, and it has become even more so now that, if New Orleans, who knows when the next time they can have a Super Bowl in New Orleans. So Miami's kind of like their fallback safe position. You get the weather, you've got the infrastructure. You've got the party scene, all the things that the NFL likes to have with it, because obviously just having the championship game is not enough, so they have to have everything else. And so, yeah, Miami is the right place for it, every 4 or 5 years. And, certainly, when you're down here, it just is a great place to be, and the game feels right, being in this locale.
All right, Paul, I hate to do this to you.
Oh, no, Bill.
Yeah, I really hate to do this to you.
This is part of the segment I really love.
But here's your Super Bowl prediction from our season preview back on September 2nd, 2006. First, you acknowledged the superior talent of the Indianapolis Colts, and then you said...
I think that the Miami Dolphins under Nick Saban, they're going to be the surprise of the AFC. And the NFC, I really think Dallas is the best team there.
All right, we gave you another chance on the 7th of January of this year, and here were your choices then.
Chicago is the favorite going in, but I'm going to go with the Eagles. But whoever makes it to the NFC is going to lose to the AFC team, so that means I pick the Ravens to win the Super Bowl.
All right, because we're nice people here at Only a Game, you got still another chance on the 20th of January.
I'm on record already in the Sporting News magazine this week of picking the Patriots and picking the Saints, and I'm not going to move off of that.
All right. That was Karen's giggle in there that time, not mine. And here's your last chance to really nail this sucker down.
Right now, everyone, all your listeners out there saying, why are we asking this guy?
Well, all our listeners have stopped listening because they're calling their bookmakers to bet on the Bears, because you let it out of the bag a minute ago. You think the Colts are going to win.
That's right, and I've picked it right along. You saw that way back in the first thing. Remember, I mentioned the Colts. So I was close. You got to at least give me that much, Bill.
You mentioned a lot of football teams.
Well, again, this shows you why I don't bet.
Wise choice.
I want to point out, by the way, that we picked every week in the Sporting News. We have a panel of experts who picked, and I actually won it this year. Now, I mean, that's a shock. It shocked me, too, but I actually did win that part of it.
Who are you picking against? I really have doubts about your colleagues.
These guys are all looking for another line of work.
Have you ever considered making your prediction and then just telling all your friends to bet on the other team?
Yeah, they do it already. They've already understood how it goes. So I have smart friends.
Paul Attner covers the NFL for the Sporting News, and he joins me from time to time during the football season. Paul, thank you again. Have a great off season. It's been fun, and start working on those 2008 predictions now. Okay?
I've got my dice out here right now, Bill, and we're working on it as we speak. So. Thanks. I enjoyed it as always.
Most fans in Chicago and Indianapolis already know who they'll be cheering for on Super Bowl Sunday, but for some of those living between the two cities, it's been a tougher decision, unless it's been an easier one. Joseph Casco of member station WVPE in Elkhart, Indiana, has our report.
When you walk into Tailgater's Sports Bar in South Bend, people are talking about the Super Bowl. According to patron Tom Pecci, Super Bowl 41 presents an ideal matchup.
It's great. You can't beat it. If you're in Indiana, especially South Bend, and you like the Colts and the Bears, I mean, that's a dream come true.
That's a sentiment shared by his girlfriend, longtime Bears fan, Duane Schaefer.
How can you ask for anything better but your two favorite teams in the Super Bowl? I should be there. I really feel bad that I'm not there.
Schaefer will spend game day with her boyfriend, Pecci, a lifelong Colts fan.
It's going to be tense because she's going to be going for the Bears and I'll be for the Colts, and she'll probably just say, stay away from me. Because if the Colts start doing bad, I have a tendency to, say some choice words to the TV or the refs.
Schaefer jokes the outcome of the game could have some serious ramifications on their relationship.
So this could be marriage or no marriage right here.
So if the Colts win, will Tom have to sleep on the couch?
I don't particularly care where he sleeps as long as the Bears win.
At Dick's Sporting Goods in Mishawaka, Daryl Steinhagen is buying a couple of T-shirts in preparation for the big game. Steinhagen has picked out a Bears shirt for himself and a Colts shirt for his mother.
Well, she just, I don't know, she just likes the Colts. You know, she feels like it. She lives in Indiana, and she ought to go for the Indiana team, I guess.
Steinhagen adds they might have a hard time watching the game together.
There's going to be a lot of yelling and screaming, probably. I might have to watch a game downstairs.
Shauna Tharp from Elkhart says she'll be rooting for the Bears on Sunday, but admits,
I wouldn't be sad if the Colts won, but I'm a Bears fan. True heart.
Teresa Rode from Rochester shares a similar noncommittal view.
I'd rather the Colts win since they haven't since they've moved to Indiana, but to me, either one. Grew up with Bears, and until Colts moved here, I was always Bears, so I'm both.
Brenda Borntrager from Elkhart says she's also supporting both teams.
It's a no-lose situation. Born and raised a Bear fan, but have liked the Colts and Peyton Manning for the last 5 years or so. That's what makes it hard and nice at the same time.
Clarence Thomas, who's also from Elkhart, is judicious when discussing where his loyalties lie.
I'm going to be rooting for both teams in the Super Bowl because, you know, I've watched both teams all year, have enjoyed the fine works that they've done, and can't wait to see a good game. Just hope for a good game. Don't want to see a blowout, you know?
Thomas says someone should design a product that appeals to other fans like him.
Somebody could make a lot of money if they made, you know, cut a shirt down the middle and put Bears on one side and the Colts on the other. And I don't know if anybody's done it, but there you go. That's your instant money maker if you want to make some, huh?
Bears-Colts isn't exactly one of the NFL's celebrated rivalries. Though it's not Bears-Packers or Colts-Patriots, the game still has piqued the interest of Northern Indiana fans. But if Super Bowl 41 goes down in history as one of the best ever, it will build the foundation of a great rivalry. Maybe then, fans living in between Chicago and Indianapolis will be able to pick a favorite and stick with it. For Only a Game, I'm Joseph Casco in Elkhart, Indiana.
If you're a member of the Weekend Late Risers Club or find yourself otherwise indisposed when Only a Game hits the conventional airwaves, please go to onlyagame.org and click on podcast. It's 19 minutes past. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, Super Bowl Haiku XIII, because the program is not quite XIV years old. But first, tomorrow's football game will draw interest for many reasons. Some observers will be wondering whether Peyton Manning can win the Super Bowl. Some are looking forward to television's most expensive commercials, and millions of people have bet on the Bears. Or the Colts, or how many points the two teams will combine to score, or whether the first touchdown will be scored before the first field goal, or the coin flip. Michael Koenig is something of an authority on sports gambling. He's the author of The Smart Money, How the World's Best Sports Bettors Beat the Bookies Out of Millions, and he joins me now from the studios of NPR West. Michael Koenig, welcome to Only a Game.
Glad to be with you, Bill.
Your expertise is based in part on your previous employment, beginning in 1997, by Rick Big Daddy Matthews, whom you identify as the head of an organization called the Brain Trust. Tell us a little bit about Rick Matthews and what you did for him.
Rick is the kingpin of the largest betting syndicate in America. This group, the Brain Trust, bets between $500,000 and $1 million every game that they gamble on. And they are not in it for fun or entertainment or relaxation. They are in it to gain an edge over the bookmakers and the casinos. They are easily the most feared betting group in America, and they single-handedly move the point spread, the line, around the world. My involvement was originally as, I guess you would call me, a human mule. Big Daddy Matthews can't walk into a Vegas casino and bet all the money he wants to bet. They don't want his business. So he needed to have people like me who could present a convincing front as a high roller from Hollywood who had more money than common sense. Meanwhile, I was privy to the Brain Trust's smart money plays.
You maintain that virtually nobody but Rick Matthews can beat the bookies betting on sports. Why?
Well, there's probably 10 people in America who can consistently beat the point spread. And the reason why is the bookies make a very, very good line. The average person, or even the what we would call the half-sharp person, can't overcome the 11 to 10 advantage that the bookmaker has. You have to bet $11 to win 10. And because of that, you have to pick 52.5% winners just to break even. The point spread usually so accurately defines the disparity between two mismatched teams that most people, or their girlfriend, or their dartboard, or their pet monkey, can't do better than 50%. Big Daddy Matthews and the Brain Trust has a legendary black box, a little computer that, over years of refinement, has figured out how to look deeper into the true power of the teams than the bookmakers can. This computer plays the game out in millions of simulations through a neural network and gives a better, more profound understanding of what's really going on in the game.
In some ways, this was an odd business for you to be involved in, because early in The Smart Money, you acknowledge, quote, "I'm not cut out for high-stakes gambling. It doesn't thrill me. It nauseates me." What about the work made you sick?
I'm a working man. You know, I'm an ink-stained wretch. I grew up in a middle-class household where we were inculcated with the twin virtues of work and study, and I know how hard it is to actually earn a living and then to wildly gamble what I would earn in a year of labor on some field goal kicker's left toe. That was upsetting to me. And, you know, at first, when I was a member of the Brain Trust, my end of the business was 10%. It eventually was raised. But even then, when we were betting, let's say, $55,000 on a college football game, it was very difficult for me at the start to divorce myself from the reality that, man, I'm betting $5,500 on a football game. How long would that take me to write freelance magazine articles to come up with that kind of money?
Well, we're talking about a tremendous amount of money here, potentially. You worked for Rick Matthews for about 3 years, several football seasons, basketball as well. How much money did you end up realizing from that association?
Millions. And the weird thing about it is I never really figured out exactly how much the Brain Trust in total was winning. I could extrapolate that it had to be tens, perhaps hundreds of millions, but I was never able to figure out exactly how many people like me were part of the organization or exactly how much we were betting in sum on some of these games.
Well, given that kind of bonanza, what led you to strike out on your own in 2000?
There's something very unsatisfying about just betting somebody else's intelligent picks. And I always found myself seduced by the notion of winning at a game that few people could, and sort of proving that I knew more about this subject than I did when I started 3 years earlier. And I really liked the idea of putting all the knowledge I had gleaned from working with the Brain Trust into my own organization and seeing how I could do on a proportionally smaller level. My association with a group that became known as the Hollywood Boys was probably the high point of my sports betting career. I wasn't exactly Big Daddy myself, but I felt like a medium daddy.
Michael, we've been talking about Big Daddy Rick Matthews in the present tense, but in fact, you say toward the end of your book that he retired from the sports gambling business back in 2003. What's he up to these days?
Hustling people on the golf course. Dabbling in his restaurant ventures. This is a very restless kind of guy. But the sad part for Big Daddy Matthews was that Like I said, I don't think it was about the money for him. It was the thrill of winning at a game that nobody could. And when both the government and the bookies and the casinos and everybody involved just made it such aggravation to just get a bet down, where he had to go through all these, this whole choreography of deceit just to lay the man 11-10, he eventually realized enough was enough.
And could the same be said of you? Are you, going to watch tomorrow's game without any money riding on it?
No, I will have something riding on it, and I think that's almost my American duty to have something riding on it. I mean, it's the Super Bowl, after all. It's funny, Bill, because in the Smart Money, there's one of my favorite chapters is when I actually got to bet on the Super Bowl for the first time as a member of the Brain Trust. And previously, like every other American, when I watched the Super Bowl, you know, I'd have $10 on the game, $20 on the game, just like everybody does. And I would scream forcefully at the referees and cheer and curse and have a great time. In 1998, the first year that I bet on the Super Bowl with the Brain Trust, I bet $288,000 on the game. And I found that I was screaming just as forcefully and cursing the referees with just as much passion. And now that I'm not involved in it, when I watch the Super Bowl, I want to be rooting for somebody. And even if it's $20 on the game, I want to have that vicarious involvement.
Michael Koenig is the author of The Smart Money, How the World's Best Sports Bettors Beat the Bookies Out of Millions. It's published by Simon & Schuster. He joined me from the studios of NPR West in Los Angeles. Michael, thank you very much for speaking with me. And, good luck on the game there.
It's been a pleasure. Bet smart.
We received more Super Bowl haiku in the mail this week than we can acknowledge. I'll share with you some of them now. One of the most optimistic entries came from Julia Voigt, who hears only a game on WFYI in Indianapolis. Super Bowl Sunday, teams from the country's heartland entertain the rest. It's a lovely thought, given the number of Super Bowls that have been lopsided rather than entertaining. Scott Suma, who teaches 7th grade in Rockford, Illinois, assigned the composition of Super Bowl haiku as homework. Of the results, he wrote, "The quality of the haiku was pure 7th grade. Lots of, the Bears really suck, and the Colts are stupid." Gee, I wish I'd thought of those lines myself. Anyway, the grand prize winner among the entries from Mr. Suma's students is as follows. One ball, two good teams, one game, one field. One will win, it will start, it ends. Diane Folds didn't indicate where she's from on her email, but it's got to be someplace between Maine and Northern Connecticut. Her haiku reads, "Football Super Bowl, the biggest game of the year. No Pats, no purpose." Elaine Reichert must have been feeling similarly glum when she penned her haiku somewhere in Minnesota, having apparently moved there from Wisconsin. She wrote, "Super Bowl is here. Big screen plasma and snacks. Where are my Packers?" David Graff's gripe is not so much with which teams are in the Super Bowl as with the location of the game. Mr. Graff hears only a game on WRNI in Rhode Island, and he wrote, "Bears and Colts belong on a cold and windy plain, not in a hot swamp." Tim Fendergast of Raymond, New Hampshire, is uncomfortable with the gap between the conference championship games and the Super Bowl. His haiku reads, "Fortnight of non-news, bye week crushes, will to live, hyperbole kills." From Oro Valley, Arizona, Lois Berkowitz takes up a by now familiar theme. Two black coaches, yes. Fans take notice. Players, too. There are no losers. And finally, we heard from Mark Chubb, if that really is his name, who resides in Christchurch, New Zealand. His haiku reads, "Extra large am I, Super Bowl 41 now, fans resemble bears." Thanks to all of you who took up the Super Bowl haiku challenge. I'm sorry I couldn't read them all. I hope you won't feel it's anticlimactic to present now only a game's Super Bowl haiku XII. Bye.
X, 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 I.
Actually, XLI.
Okay, X, L, I.
Bears Cub quarterback? Old Mare Colt? Stage is set for two calls to the vet.
High in the cheap seats. Wait, today, high's redundant. And there's no cheap seat.
Super Bowl shows us life is truth and pain, the game.
So we all watch it.
We were patriots. So, Bob, now we're bears, horses? Hello, Mr. Kraft.
High against dark sky, kicked bull, ox, pigs, sighs, tips toward carnage far below.
Super Bowl menu. Roadkill bear if Peyton's hot. If not, horse burgers.
Defense is stopping. Offense declining to stop. Again and again.
Colts run wild and free. Gallop over grass, prone bears. Manning need not pass.
Fans root for their teams. Sponsors root for a close game. Pigs root for truffles.
Bears fans recall Fridge, Shuffle. Indy, Johnny U. Fatheads v. Legend.
USA, Big Bucks. Restitched torn ligaments and bouncing cheerleaders.
Do we, smiles wider, titillating a nation, get more if they win?
Limping man, joints sprung, hobbles to trainer's table.
Make it go once more.
Fired ad rider weeps.
Never mind injured players. This game wrecks careers.
Win bet flickering, over under number dead. Maybe basketball.
Sudden as surprise, the hole gapes, then more sudden, closes for no gain.
Down two, near game's close, kickers cool. This year, don't bet holders' hands aren't slick.
Hey, Mayfair horses, no oat or sugar cube safe. Gawky colts, bears eat.
It took 13 years, but Super Bowl Haiku has finally ascended to a galaxy far, far away. Thanks, Yoda. I hope that welcome I am you are, or whatever. Have we established over the years that the pairing of football and haiku is a brilliant match? Well, I hope so, or I hope at least that you've had as much fun as we have with the goofy attempt to do so, and if it hasn't worked for you yet, as Yoda might say,
next year, always there is.
And maybe then we'll be waxing pseudo-poetic about your team. You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com. This is NPR.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Ice Cats Blow Cool and Strum, Pick, and Drum quite well, too. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Let me just adjust my robes, and then, if you would, as is your custom, you might provide the invocation?
The Super Bowl is good.
Thank you very much. Bears fans who believe in omens had to be uneasy after what happened outside the Art Institute of Chicago this week.
Yeah, they don't make fake large helmets for lion statues like they used to in Chicago. They put like hats and things on these lions outside the Art Institute to celebrate various sporting events and things going on in Chicago. And they had the hat ready to go, and because it was so cold, it broke.
Yeah, as if this can't be good.
It's not. It's a terrible omen for the Bears. And, of course, they have done this with batting helmets for the baseball teams.
And it's always worked for the
Cubs. It's always worked for the Cubs and the White Sox, of course, at least once every 80 years. But the difference was the face masks complicated things. Okay. Now, if you really wanted to get into the spirit of the Chicago Bears, the monsters of the Midway, what are you doing with face guards on the helmet in the first place?
The NFL, also known as the No Fun League, is living up to its reputation as far as various churches that wanted to host Super Bowl parties are concerned. What's the issue between the league and the clergy?
Well, the issue is the Super Bowl, while being good, is a wholly owned trademark of the National Football League. So therefore, you have to, if you're going to promote whatever event it is, be it wet t-shirt contests or Jesus, in connection with the Super Bowl, you can't use the word Super Bowl. In fact, I might have NFL lawyers waiting for me at the door today if I continue to say Super Bowl as often as I've said Super Bowl in our Super Bowl preview on Super Bowl weekend here on Only a Game.
We'll say big game from now on.
Yes, you have to say the big game in Miami or demi godlike exercise in Miami. But whatever you do, don't say Super Bowl because you're not supposed to say Super Bowl unless the National Football League allows you to say Super Bowl.
The former professional gambler with whom I spoke earlier in the program advised me to take the Bears and the points tomorrow. Charlie, sound like a good idea to you?
I do, and I think the part of the reason to do so is a guy named Devin Hester, who's their kickoff return and punt return specialist. Last week against Indianapolis, Ellis Hobbs, whom nobody will ever confuse with Gale Sayers, had an enormous game. And Devin Hester's the kind of guy who can make plays and break the pattern of a game all by himself. So, yes, I think a touchdown or a touchdown plus is a little bit too much for this game.
This week, retired New England Patriots linebacker Ted Johnson, 34 years old, alleged that his being forced to practice in 2002 while recovering from a concussion that he had suffered only a few days before has caused forgetfulness, depression, and addiction to amphetamines. Are you convinced when he asserts that he knows exactly when something began to go wrong with his brain?
I think most people who studied brain injury and neurological injury realize that at some level people know. People who study Alzheimer's disease say that most times, most patients realize at some point something has gone wrong. They're not able to articulate it, although they're better able to articulate it now as the profile of the disease gets a little higher. The NFL has ignored this problem. It's put Band-Aids on it. It's pretend to shuffle it aside. A couple of weeks ago, he had Andre Waters dying, and upon autopsy revealing that he had, if not Alzheimer's, certainly a similar form of dementing illness. There are going to be more and more of this. I mean, I don't know that you can hang everything that's gone wrong with Teddy Johnson since he left the Patriots upon post-concussion syndrome, but you can certainly hang a lot of it on there, and Bill Belichick has somebody to answer for besides somebody's husband in New Jersey.
Barbaro, the horse that won the Kentucky Derby
last May. He's dead, Bill!
I startled. Anyway, he broke his leg running in the Preakness, as you will recall, was put down Monday. Our mutual friend ESPN writer Pat Forty took advantage of that unfortunate necessity to offer some recommendations to the racing industry. Good ideas from Pat?
Well, one of the things that Pat Forte is recommending, and may I point out that it's a good thing that he now writes for ESPN.com and not the Louisville paper anymore,
yes.
is that we don't run horses as three-year-olds anymore, which will sort of like take out a certain large horse race that makes Louisville a lot of money. I think they should take better care of the horses. I really do. I think the NFL should take better care of its athletes. I think everybody should take better care of everybody else. But I am glad that they've managed to dispose of the remains of Barbaro with a little bit more alacrity than James Brown's relatives seem to have.
Major League Baseball rejected the contract that the Giants offered Barry Bonds for reasons that only the best contract lawyers can understand, I guess. Is Bonds the only major leaguer with a clause in his contract that protects the employer should the employee be indicted?
Yeah, I think that was the problem. I think that neither side has got the legal infrastructure in place to deal with what is going to be a very bizarre couple of years. The lawyers for the union and the commissioner's office agreed last year that there weren't going to be any more of what were called appearance provisions. Nobody knows whether that covers the fact that you can't play because you're, you know, in jail. So once again, Barry Bonds breaking new ground in almost everything.
The NBA's leading scorer was not named this week to the Western Conference All-Star team. Has the league suddenly decided that defense should be stressed in All-Star games?
No, the league has suddenly decided that public relations should be stressed in all manner of things. Carmelo Anthony won't be there, probably because he got involved in that punch-up in New York. This is really stupid. Mike D'Antoni from the Phoenix Suns, you know, really, I understand that, you know, you're trying to get as many of your guys in the team, but the guy is leading the league in scoring. People do want to see him play. The game is for the fans. Put him on the damn team, will you?
Charlie, if you were a fan of fabled English side Liverpool, how would you feel that your team may soon be co-owned by a guy whose Major League Baseball team has never won anything?
This is very strange. I remember when Malcolm Glazer tried to buy Manchester United, and they practically, you know, they hung him in effigy only because they couldn't get their hands on the real things. Now we have Tom Hicks, who owns the Texas Rangers and the Dallas Stars, once won a Stanley Cup, by the way, reportedly joining with the guy who owns the Montreal Canadiens.
They won some stuff.
And not only that, he's also an American, which was a big deal in Montreal.
I remember
it
well.
In a real kind of one-world, globalized, we-all-hate-our-owners attempt to buy Liverpool.
Andrei Karpov lost his wife in a poker
what?
Game, Charlie. After he had run out of money, he needed some sort of collateral in order to stay in the game. Explain to me how a story that begins like that can have a happy ending.
Well, actually, she was very nice. Once he picked her up and slapped her on top of the chips in the middle of the table, she got mad, divorced him, and married the guy he lost her to.
Yeah.
And they all lived happily ever after in the land of loony bins.
Charlie Fierce, who's Aces with me, writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Stick with me, baby. I'm the fella you came in with. Luck be a lady. Luck be a lady. Luck be a lady.
My name is Brian Mullen. I play the drums, and I'm a defenseman.
Matthew Palomina. I play piano, and I'm right wing.
I'm Rory Given. I play bass guitar, and I just sort of, you know, go wherever they tell me. I don't really know much about hockey.
In the locker room before the Berkeley Ice Cats, the hockey team representing the Berklee College of Music in Boston, would face crosstown arch rival Emerson College in a mid-January game, the mood was not especially tense. Though a few minutes before Brian Mullen, Matthew Palomina, and Rory Given introduced themselves, there was, at least according to Palomina, some concern about whether enough Berklee players would show up.
Last week we had five forwards, so it was kind of rough. But it's hit or miss. Sometimes we have a full squad, sometimes we don't.
The unpredictability of the turnout may be partly a function of the novelty of this team in particular and sports in general at Berklee. The college lacks, among other things, an athletic department. That did not discourage John Kingsley, a guitar player and forward who began organizing the team by posting flyers wherever he thought Berklee students might see them. Kingsley figured Berkeley's performers could hold their own against such aggregations as the Moose Knuckles, the Brawlers, and the Suffolk Nordiques in an informal league. And according to de facto captain Jimmy Gately, another guitarist, some of the people who responded to the Flyers could play.
There's a couple good hockey players, yeah. I'm really happy that I had these guys on the team.
How'd you get to be captain?
I don't know. I guess I just kind of took charge. I mean, I love the game a lot, so I don't know. I just kind of took charge and was like, you know, let's condition, let's get back in shape instead of just goofing off on the ice.
We love it.
During this particular game, the couple of good hockey players on both teams confidently swing the puck around their own nets and push it up the ice, though shots on goal are as likely to dribble and skid as they are to soar. The Berkeley squad appears to get stronger and more confident as the game goes on, and the mighty music school goes into the final minutes, leading 3-2. More important, despite a couple of penalties for roughing and holding, nobody's gotten hurt. A good thing, because the medical staff consists of Cindy Silva, mother of drummer and left-wing Charlie Silva. Between her mittened hands, she holds a first aid kit.
We've only had to use one Band-Aid so far.
All right, you got some Band-Aids. Yeah. You got some tape. You got a screwdriver and some, yeah. So you can fix a skate, a helmet that comes loose, yeah. A strap or something, right? Yeah.
Pack.
Ice pack, hot pack.
Yeah. And we got cell phones for 911.
A goal in the final seconds of the game gives Berkeley a 4-2 win. As the players file back into the cinder block locker room to remove their skates, the mood among the Ice Cats is upbeat.
Berkeley hockey prevails once again against Emerson. That's 3-0. Do you realize that? 3-0.
Do you think they'll show up next time?
I hope so. Seems like we're the only team we have any luck against. I'm kidding you guys. You know I am.
I'm not kidding. A moment later, I stopped Scott Mulcahy, one of the game's two officials. He's presided over various levels of hockey, mites, midgets, and squirts, as well as college and club leagues, and I wonder out loud if he wishes things had moved a little more quickly on this chilly evening.
Oh, no, these things are a blast. We have so much fun out here. You know, the kids, the guys, they make it fun. I have fun, you know.
Nobody takes it too seriously?
Oh, everybody takes it too seriously. Everybody. They may be playing for the Stanley Cup, they think, out there, but it's fun. It's all they have left in their lives now with hockey.
A few days later, Berkeley's hockey players are back at work on the lives they are beginning to build as musicians. Walking through the halls of the college, you can hear everything from gospel to rock to rap. In a room at the end of one of the winding corridors, Emily Hockman, one of the two women who skates for Berkeley, plays electric bass for a jazz ensemble. This is the first class of the spring semester, and these students, a drummer, two guitarists, and a horn player, plus the instructor on piano, haven't previously worked together. During a break, I asked Emily Hockman what it was like to sit down with a bunch of strangers and play.
It's fun. It's like slightly exhilarating because, you know, you're a little bit nervous, and you're like, I haven't played with these people, but you want to make a good impression and also, you know, play well. And yeah, and then you just get a good groove going with everybody else.
Is there any comparison between that feeling and stepping onto the ice with a bunch of people you've never played hockey with before?
Definitely. It's a very similar situation. Playing ice hockey with people, you know, being able to, like, pass the puck around is kind of, like, similar, I guess, like, you know, playing music, kind of call and response, and, like, being able to mesh well with people even though you haven't necessarily done anything with them like that before. You don't know what to expect.
In fact, when she responded to one of the Flyers seeking hockey players, Emily Hockman, who played for 3 years on the boys' hockey team at Montclair High School in New Jersey, probably had a better idea of what to expect than most of her future teammates did.
There was a time in high school when I played on, like, 3 teams a season and, like, 2 in the off season. Like, I played girls' travel hockey, I played boys' high school hockey, and I played boys' club hockey. And then, like, I would play on, like, a spring league team, one girls' spring league team and one boys'. So I used to play a whole lot of hockey.
Now she plays a lot of electric bass, but Emily Hockman welcomed the opportunity to take up hockey again as a college student, although she has decided not to get too involved with her teammates.
We've done things like we all went to a Bruins game. A bunch of them are talking about getting a house together, which I'm not going to take part of, but...
The hockey house.
They tried to rope me into that, but living with a bunch of messy hockey boys, not appealing to me.
Like most of her teammates, Hockman hopes that the Berkeley squad, which is currently competing in a men's senior league, might one day be an authentic and official varsity team in a college that lacks not only a hockey rink, but a coach. That would seem to be a considerable leap. And as far as Berkeley's dean of students, Larry Bethune, himself a former athlete, is concerned, such a development might not even be appropriate given Berkeley's curriculum.
Being a jazz, rock, pop school, I sort of like the improvisational nature of this whole thing, and that you don't know where the tour is going to go or when it's going to end. But you're just going to play every concert as if it's the last.
If chief hockey recruiter and organizer John Kingsley, Captain Jimmy Gately, and electric bassist Emily Hockman have their way, the last Berklee College of Music hockey game won't come for a long time. Hockman, for one, feels she and her teammates have a stake in what they've created.
I guess we're all a little bit pioneers, yeah, because we're... I mean, I think that they've tried before to start ice hockey clubs, but it's all flopped before. And I'm really glad this has got off the ground, and yeah, that we're leaving Berkeley with this, and that hopefully it'll continue past when I'm gone.
Recent evidence that the Ice Cats may indeed endure includes the on-ice presence of former Boston Bruins stalwart Johnny Pye McKenzie at a couple of practices. The Berklee College of Music team will next play Emerson College yet again on Wednesday night in Boston, a game that will feature Berklee's John Kingsley and Doug Ory, whom we'll now hear on banjo and fiddle. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Special thanks to the Only a Game Hut Hut Haiku players, Christine Fischera, Keith Shields, Anna Benstead, Kelvin Brooks, Sean Cole, Matt Odette, James Isaacs, Walter Dixon, and George Hicks. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view my Berklee hockey photo gallery, check out this year's Super Bowl haiku roster, learn more about the smart money, listen to stories past and present, or perhaps sign up for our newsletter. Boy, that's a lot of stuff. Please visit onlyagame.org. In our final word, haiku superstar Anna Benstead offers this bit of advice for future Super Bowl haiku readers from England.
You can't be English and titillating nations.
Yeah, no, you can't sound like the Queen when you're doing that.
Oh, yeah? Well, what about when they read Queen Elizabeth's naughty World Cup limericks, cheeky devils? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at BreakthroughCollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning at DigitalLearning.MacFound.org.